What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, Tuesdays 4 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Pacifica Affiliates WXOJLP-FM, Northampton, Massachusetts, and KWMD Kasilof in Anchorage, Alaska. Produced by Freedom Center and the Icarus Project, streaming, podcasting, and archive at madnessradio.net. Welcome to Madness Radio. This is your host, Will Hall. And today we have David Lukoff. David is a licensed clinical psychologist. He is a professor of psychology at the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology in Palo Alto, California. And he was the co-author of a category in the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, of religious or spiritual problem. He is a pioneer in the effort to get spiritual emergence issues, spiritual crisis, madness and psychosis experiences that have a spiritual aspect to them recognized by the mental health system. So welcome to Madness Radio, David Lukoff.
Okay, well, good to be here, Will.
Well, it's really interesting having you on the show because you're an example of someone who is now a practicing professional in the system, but you also had your own personal experiences with a psychiatric or mental health crisis. Is that right?
Yes, really that has been the foundation of my subsequent work over the last 35 years on bringing spirituality into clinical practice. It was an episode that certainly would have looked very psychotic to mental health professionals at the time. And yet I do consider it to be my spiritual awakening and also my experiential basis for developing expertise in this area without having any prior education academically in religious history or theology. I'm not a spiritual teacher. I'm not a minister or a rabbi. And yet I have become an expert on this area of spirituality and clinical practice. And there are many other experts for sure. But I have about 80 publications in this area and have been one of the co-authors of this category in the DSM-4, which is often called the Bible of Mental Health because it has to be. The codes in the DSM-4 are part of any clinical institution's practice. The all hospitals, all clinics, all hospices and so on are involved in making these kinds of DSM diagnoses.
And your work has been very successful, and I know that there are some there's some recent developments in California that I want to talk to you more about, and I want to hear the story about getting the diagnostic category into the DSM. But maybe we can just start by you telling us about that crisis that you had, that spiritual awakening experience that you had. It happened when you were quite young, is that right?
Well, it happened when I was a graduate student at Harvard in social anthropology. I was 23 years old, and I had just gotten my master's degree and had what I would consider to be an existential crisis of questioning who I was, and here I was at 23, about to embark on the final stages of determining my professional career. And at the time, I was also living together with a woman, and we were talking about getting married. And I just went through this crisis about having so little true life experience. I'd been in school my entire life. Even during summers, I had worked at universities and stuff. And as part of that crisis, I dropped out of Harvard and got rid of everything I owned that wouldn't fit into a backpack and started hitchhiking around the United States.
Now, David, were you in kind of distress when you were doing this, or was it just more like a coming of age kind of thing that you really need to sort of shake up your life? Or,
well, it was the latter. It really was an existential crisis of questioning who I was and what my meaning and purpose in life was at the time. It was kind of, it is common, I would say, of people in their late teens and early 20s to have these kinds of questions about identity and so on.
And you were going pretty fast, it sounds like. 23 is pretty young to be graduating from
gotten into college without graduating high school in a program that let people go to college early. I was not very socially integrated in my high school. It was just, I mean, I had some really good friends, but the day-to-day routine of going to high school was a drag. And so the idea, I was slated for my senior year to take four honors courses and instead decided to take my first year of college at a college, I mean AP courses. Anyway, at 23, when I had my master's degree, you know, as I say, that had been my life. I should also mention my father was a professor, so I grew up in that culture. And even my grandfather, my mother's father, was a rabbi and a professor. Had both full-time jobs going.
So there's also kind of like a lot of pressure in the background for success and following your family's footsteps and those kinds of things, I imagine.
Yes, and it's kind of funny that now I am in academia, but part of what I was questioning at that age of 23 while I was a graduate student was do I want to be an academic? Is that really my calling, or is that just what, you know, I kind of grew up with, you know?
So you decided to drop out of Harvard, and then you went on this, you got rid of all your possessions and went on this backpacking, hitchhiking experience.
You know, even though it was 1971, it was really culturally what we call the 60s, you know, it was, there was this whole kind of hippie culture, and people picked up people, you know, a lot. It was not, you know, there was a whole group of people hitchhiking around the country at the time.
Yeah, you weren't the only person, I guess, who had dropped out of Harvard to travel around and find yourself, it sounds like, is what you were doing.
I did end up, and was one of my destinations, in San Francisco, you know, somebody offered me a tab of LSD, and I had kind of been on this theme, you know, even literally listening to the song, you know, over and over again, On the Road to Find Out by Cat Stevens. And so I felt like, you know, I was on the road to find out, meet new kinds of people, have new kinds of experiences. So I took the LSD.
Did you have much sense of what you were kind of in for? Because LSD is, I mean, it's a mixed bag, but for some people it can be extremely powerful experience.
Well, ultimately it was, but when I actually took it, I had a, you know, what I would describe as a pleasant experience. And at the end of that day, I, you know, said, oh, well, this is kind of interesting. I enjoyed the perceptual, you know, kind of visual show, but it didn't seem to have any other effect on me at the time. And then the next day I woke up and pulled out a book I had been, had my backpack and been trying to read and had not made any sense to me, which was a book by Alan Watts on Zen and enlightenment. And all of a sudden, it made perfect sense to me. You know, all this stuff about enlightenment, seen through social games, and so on. I mean, it just spoke to me. You know, and I started to kind of became a page turner to me.
Yeah, I have to say, Alan Watts is very wonderful. I mean, he's a really great writer. If anybody's listening to this and you haven't read Alan Watts, I mean, I don't know what you think about him today, but I certainly haven't read that particular book. But I've read other Alan Watts, and it is really pretty mind-blowing writing, actually.
Yes, yes, and there's actually a number of free podcasts of his talks that are available on iTunes.
Oh, yeah, and I think also someone told me there's some videos as well. So just, you know, Google Alan Watts, WATTS, and you'll go on your own journey, I guess. So you started reading the book that you've been not really understanding, but after the LSD experience, suddenly it starts making sense to you.
And then four days after I took the LSD, I woke up in the middle of the night and walked into the bathroom. And as I was walking in, I looked in the mirror, and for some reason I was holding my right hand up in a mudra position that you sometimes see the Buddha in, you know, with the thumb and the first the four finger in a circle and other fingers spreading out from that. And when I looked at it in the mirror, it was glowing. It was giving off a white light. And immediately I knew what that meant. It meant that I was a reincarnation of Buddha. And following right on that, I had another insight that I was also the a reincarnation of Christ, and that I had a mission, a new mission, that was to create a world religion, that Buddha had created a religion for the East, and Christ had created a religion for the West, which also shows how uninformed I was about spirituality at the time, but that's how I viewed it, and that I was to write the holy book for a new world religion.
Now, we should say that the LSD had worn off at this point. I mean, an acid trip is maybe 6-8 hours, so you had come down from the LSD, but then something was maybe activated or triggered inside of you that you opened up just yourself without being under the influence of the drug. Is that fair to say?
Right. And I think it started a chain of thinking, beginning with the Alan Watts reading, because as part of this, I thought of myself as enlightened, like Buddha, you know, and I had this sense that I had seen through all of the social games, and now because of that, and because I had studied anthropology at Harvard, and I had studied ancient civilizations at the University of Chicago, that, you know, I had been prepared to write this new holy book. And I sat down and I started to write in the book that I was carrying around as a diary, kind of, a new holy book. And I stayed up pretty much over the next 5 days writing this, getting an hour nap here and an hour nap there, but pretty much focused on writing this and having conversations. And they were kind of in my mind, but they were conversations with, you know, not only Buddha and Christ, but, you know, people like Socrates and Plato and Rousseau and Locke about, you know, how to, the social contract, you know, how do people live together? And also with Margaret Mead about, you know, because of her cross-cultural wisdom. And also with Bob Dylan and Cat Stevens because of their ability to get kind of their perspectives out into the world. I thought, you know, I should have conversations with them. And also with Freud and Jung because of their, you know, enhanced understanding or advanced understanding of human psychology.
This wasn't just something that was happening like when we imagine conversations. You really felt like you were communing with those spirits or having a dialogue with them.
Exactly. Yeah. I really thought I was conversing with them.
So it's kind of like a channeling experience, you could say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what was the quality of this? Because I know when sometimes people go into states where they feel inspired to give a message to the world, or they feel like they are the incarnation of the Buddha or the Christ, that it can be a very egotistical, kind of like grandiose, like I'm better than everybody else and listen to me, and it's kind of like high speed, really sort of self-centered. And then other times it can be much more heartful and open and more humble, which I think is really what the teachings are more about, that we're all in some sense the Buddha and we're all in some sense the Christ. And how was it for you? Were you really kind of driven in this kind of egotistical way, or?
Well, there were certainly elements kind of both. I mean, there were some ways in which I presumed myself to be enlightened, which is certainly a superior state of being. And I also felt kind of entitled in the sense that I didn't think I had to worry about money. And my friends really were great. They let me crash with them and, you know, fed me. And so I didn't have any money. I could have easily kind of ended up in the streets, and my experience could have unfolded in a very different scenario. But What actually happened was that over the next couple of months, well, I should finish saying exactly what I did, though.
Yeah,
But
because you're writing, it sounds like you spent 4 or 5 days just writing this great spiritual treatise that you were channeling all these different voices and authors from the history from history to help you with.
And I came up with this vision or book, really, and made up 40 copies and sent off about half of them to friends and relatives of mine, my parents and so on, and distributed the other 20 in the street in Berkeley. I had kind of concluded that Berkeley was the new Jerusalem. It was going to be the new center of the earth from which this new world spirituality would unfold. Yeah, I did it in front of a famous bookstore there. And also, you know, it's funny, if you go back to that street, it looks just like it did back in 1971. There are a lot of people selling, you know, tie-dyed T-shirts and handmade jewelry and stuff like that.
And books that they stayed up all night writing themselves.
Yeah. I'll bet you that somebody else has done that since then.
Was it like Moe's or Cody's that you were in front of or something?
Cody's, yeah.
Cody's, yeah.
Cody's. And then, you know, as I said, that was, I thought I just needed to wait for these books. The books were so powerful in their vision that... you know, this would just unfold, and I would be recognized as kind of a prophet of this new religion.
Well, what kinds of things were in the book? I mean, looking back on it, was there anything that was, what was really kind of the message?
Well, I ultimately did have a chance to go back and look at it my Jungian analysis that I should also talk about in a bit. And then since then, you know, I've looked at it, and it's a very kind of 60s vision of people living together tribally and in integrated communities. And it's the kind of thing that led some people to found communes, very much a similar kind of, ideas that were kind of popping into a lot of people's minds. And you know, I think people, I certainly have been struggling with, you know, how to live closely with people in a society that doesn't really encourage that. And looking into a co-housing community, my wife are involved in as a founding group in a co-housing community. So, you know, I think they were real breakthroughs in this experience and my own understanding of what my values are. I don't think it had any real universal breakthrough qualities at all. It's not something I would think about publishing or trying to actually do in any concrete way that's described there. But it certainly was both it was also my spiritual awakening. I mean, I had prior to that really paid no attention to spirituality. If somebody brought up that whole area, I would just say, oh, I'm an agnostic, you know, and I don't really care very much about it anyway.
So the ideas in this book that you wrote, I mean, they had some real validity. It wasn't just a meaningless kind of thing that you did in the middle of the night. It had some real validity, but the real breakthrough wasn't like a world historic breakthrough. It was really a personal breakthrough you went through.
Right.
So what happened next? You sent it out and you sent copies to... your friends and relatives, and you gave them out on the street, and then how did it? And you're sort of staying with your friends. You're not really working. You're kind of crashing on people's couches and things. And then what happened?
Well, after about 2 months, I kind of came down from this, and that's something that now I've been led to my subsequent work on spiritual emergencies, because I think that would happen to a lot more people if they were allowed to go through these experiences, you know, without getting medicated, without getting hospitalized. I mean, I was lucky, I think, that, you know, if this had happened to me on the East Coast, my parents probably would have tried to get me hospitalized. But since I was on the West Coast and they were on the East Coast and I was, you know, maintaining myself in a sense through my friends, I was allowed to go through this and let it, the kind of inner journey, you know, where I was kind of exploring parts of myself, and particularly this spiritual part that I had been ignoring. I guess John Perry is a Jungian analyst who worked with people having first psychotic breaks, setting up a home for them where they could go through it without medication. He has written about it in a book called Far Side of Madness, and there's actually a number of interviews up online with him that you can find on, you know, by Googling John Perry.
Yeah, I think it was called a Diabasis House in San Francisco. Is that right?
That's right. So I was basically provided with that kind of environment, and he coined the term compensatory psychosis. In other words, if a person has really been ignoring one important dimension of the personality, they might have a psychotic episode that would kind of flip them over into an extreme version of that. And then when they kind of reintegrate, it's a more it becomes more integrated into the whole self or personality.
So you say you came down after about 2 months. Did you you like crash into a depression, or did you just sort of like have kind of more of a gentle landing where the whole experience had kind of just played itself out and you just went all the way through it?
Well, that was in a way the beginning of a number of other experiences that were very played a very significant role in my development, which was that afterwards I was very embarrassed. You know, how could I have done something so foolish? And started to have regrets about, you know, dropping out of Harvard and just questioning everything. And I did become very depressed, and even got to the point I had an illness from when I was about 13 that I had surgery for, called Crohn's disease, which affects the intestines, and I had a recurrence of that. And there were times during I was living alone in a cottage in Cape Cod that I had was my parents' summer cottage, but I just moved there to have a place to live. And during that time, I had some pain medication from a free clinic for the Crohn's, because there's not much you can do in terms of treatment. Sometimes at night, I actually saw what I took to be my own skeleton kind of hovering above myself, and seriously considered taking the pain medication to commit suicide.
Wow. And you had gone back to the East Coast now. What kinds of connections did you have with your friends and community that was supporting you when you were in this more high, expanded state, when you started to go down into this depression?
Well, in a sense, because of, I felt that I'd kind of leeching on my friends and not, you know, I mean, I didn't feel that strongly, but I felt like I was aware enough all of a sudden to think that I shouldn't just be crashing with everybody. So then I moved to my parents' cottage, because it was really a summer cottage, only used and rented out during the summer, but, you know, I moved there in March. And, I mean, it was part of what I was doing there was trying to unravel and start to understand this experience. And I started to read Jung, and I started to read Joseph Campbell, and a very influential book I read was by Richard Buck, who is a Canadian psychiatrist who wrote about cosmic consciousness, which is a term I'm sure many people are familiar with, but may not know its origins, which was from his research showing these experiences that people, and he started with Buddha, and he included Christ, and then he included Walt Whitman and his own personal experience, which got him involved in this. But he documented these kinds of visionary experiences in these people. So I started to think that what I had had was, you know, at least it validated what I had, in the sense that it made it sound like it was a, you know, positive, good experience. I started to figure out what I was going to do with my life, but it kind of gave me a positive frame for the experience.
Was that how you kind of pulled yourself out of the suicidal depression that you were facing when you were on the in Cape Cod?
Well, the thing that actually I think was the turning point was taking a walk on a beach. At the time, I was right there near the beach, and I did used to go on a walk almost every day, you know, if it wasn't like pouring rain or something. And while I was walking on the beach, you know, all by myself around the bay, the Wellfleet Bay, beautiful bay, all of a sudden I heard a voice, and I literally turned around thinking there was somebody there, and there's absolutely nobody there. And the voice, and I only heard it that one time, but it said, "Become a healer." And, I mean,
wow,
I just was totally puzzled by that. And yet it became kind of a mantra. And I started to kind of, you know, go into this, treat it almost like a koan. You know, what does it mean to become a healer? Does it mean, you know, to go to medical school? Does it mean to study herbs? Does it mean to, become a yoga teacher? You know, what does it mean to become a healer?
Because you had been in Harvard, but you were studying anthropology, or you weren't studying anything around psychology or medical or healthcare practice or anything like that.
So, I just began to experiment with different things, you know, to try to, you know, I'd actually took a course in herbs and took a class in yoga and also participated in an encounter group. I decided I should try an encounter group. I actually really, the whole encounter group, things about sharing about people and gestalt and psychodrama that was part of that group, was really, to me, eye-opening, and really it felt like a real cutting edge to me. And I ended up deciding to pursue becoming what was at the time called social therapist. And that meant you could do things like lead groups at hospitals. And I also got some more training and ended up doing a lot of gestalt groups and psychodrama groups.
And if you're just tuning in, this is Madness Radio. We're interviewing David Lukoff, who is a clinical psychologist and a professor at the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology in Palo Alto, California. And he is working on bringing issues of spirituality into mental health and into clinical practice in the mental health system. Now, David, for people who don't know what an encounter group is or what gestalt is, tell us a little bit about what that was about and why were you so interested in it from this kind of spiritual perspective that you had developed?
Well, what I think I was still in this phase of trying to figure out who I was and who I wanted to be and become. And so I found the whole encounter process of people sharing openly with each other about how they perceive each other, what they like, what they don't like, what if they're sexually attracted to that person. I mean, things that I would have never openly talked about. And I started to find that there was a lot of value to that. Also, a theme in a couple of relationships that I'd had with women was around their saying that I didn't know how to talk about my emotions, my feelings. And here I was discovering what that really meant and the value of it. So that's why I decided that, you know, to pursue that rather than yoga or the study of herbs or something. I mean, both of which are, you know, I do respect and even partake those to some degree, but it felt to me like this was really the cutting edge, this kind of exploration. And psychodrama and gestalt are techniques whereby you're able to kind of isolate a part of your way of being in the world, your personality, you know, the way your parents, you hear your parents' voices in your head sometimes, kind of, and sometimes it's other mentors, and sometimes it's media, but we're often guided, in a sense, by some images we have of things. And to be able to explore that and really understand, how that plays out in my life, you know, I found very valuable, and I enjoyed facilitating that in other people because part of that role.
Was this the beginning of what led you to ultimately go on to become a clinical psychologist and a professor and to work with people as a therapist?
I got to graduate school and it was very traditional. You know, I learned about psychological testing, and I also took my first class in psychopathology, and it was during that class that I really kind of learned that what I had experienced would have been diagnosed in the DSM-2, which was the existing DSM at that time in the mid-70s, I would have been diagnosed with an acute schizophrenic reaction, a type of schizophrenia. And at that point, I became very, again, kind of embarrassed or actually felt that really my professional credibility would be in some way diminished if that came out. In fact, I was worried, you know, if it got out, if I talked about it, you know, in a graduate psychology program, would that, or in my subsequent internships or anything like that, you know, I really felt like that could really result in problems in my program. That totally changed my perspective on it. Because part of what I was doing was learning, you know, how to be a clinical psychologist and taking on that worldview. Part of clinical psychology training involves, traditionally, not everybody does this nowadays, but spending a year working at a psychiatric hospital. It was there that I, you know, started to encounter a number of people who had similar experiences, really. I mean, you know, similar in certainly that they believed that they were Christ or Mary or had some special mission or, you know, something like that. I had actually gone to graduate school, as I mentioned, to pursue becoming kind of a growth group leader, you know, leading Gestalt and psychodrama groups and things like that. But while I was working at this hospital, I found that I had this kind of unique ability to connect with these people, that I would be able to really accept that they were doing that their experiences had some validity, and I actually formed groups where patients could talk about these experiences. There was one I actually co-led with a rabbi, and it really focused on patients' religious hallucinations and delusions. And I also led groups at the hospital. After my internship, I actually became a psychologist at that hospital and led groups on growth and schizophrenia, where I would present the idea that, I would describe, you know, in one group, I would, in that group, I would bring in accounts of Native Americans, vision quests, of shamanic initiatory crises. I would bring in work of Van Gogh, and you know, then have the patients in the group describe how their experiences were similar to those, you know, really validating them.
So the idea is that you really were looking at what you went through as really kind of a common, maybe not common, but a shared human experience that many people throughout history in different cultures actually go through a similar kind of spiritual awakening process. Is that right?
Right. And that if people who had had those experiences, instead of having them pathologized, you know, had them validated, that they could actually grow from that experience, benefit from it. And that's kind of exactly what I'm doing today with the work with the California Department of Mental Health, is encouraging people, supporting them to make use of these kinds of religious experiences that they've had as a foundation for their development of their spiritual journey.
And you talked about the idea of an initiation crisis, and that's a common thread that goes through a lot of different cultures around the world, that someone goes into a real an illness period or they go into some kind of crisis and they have this kind of spiritual experience. And then on the other side of it, that's when they discover their calling as a healer. And it sounds like that you sort of fit that pattern. And have you seen that in other people as well, that they may have been told or the people around them see what they're going through as purely delusional or negative, but actually they end up later down the road, it ends up guiding them to becoming a healer or in some form or other?
Yes. When I have given talks and when I've given workshops related to these topics, there are often many people in the audience, in the participants of the workshop, who have had very similar experiences to my own.
Yeah, and people who listen to the radio show also know that some of my own personal experiences have a lot of parallels to what you're talking about here. David, let me ask you just a kind of a side question, which is that how frequent is it, do you think, that someone takes a psychedelic like LSD and it's not so much the drug experience, but somehow something gets triggered or unlocked or they start to take spirituality seriously, whereas before they hadn't? And I know that we've talked about this on the show before, that a lot of the teachers today who teach Buddhism in the United States, many of them actually got started on the spiritual path through a similar kind of a drug experience, or they discovered things through LSD or something, maybe not as dramatically as you did, but that was kind of the starting point for them becoming later very serious spiritual practitioners as well as healers.
Yes, and actually there's research to support that. There was an article published in the Journal of Transpersonal Psychology on the NYINGMA meditation center participants, people who were living in that community and so on. And around three-quarters of them had prior psychedelic drug experiences that led them into their meditation practice. And so I do think LSD and other psychedelic drugs have served as these kinds of openings for people, especially in terms of spiritual awakening.
Now tell us about you mentioned working with the California Department of Mental Health. Tell us about how you were able to get a new diagnosis into the DSM. I'm not a big fan of the DSM in general, but it sounds like a lot of people who would have just been given a schizophrenia diagnosis or just treated as a pathology, now that there's this new diagnosis in the DSM, there's maybe a different pathway that clinicians might look at for how to help them. So tell us about that process and how you were able to do that, because you really led that. You really led that effort, is that right?
Well, it was a team effort. There were two psychiatrists that I worked closely with during this time. The story actually starts with my work with the Spiritual Emergency Network, which then became the Spiritual Emergence Network. It was founded by Stan and Christina Groff in 1980. And their objective was to create a network of people who could work with people having spiritual crises, you know, some like my own, some related to things like kundalini that can get raised by people doing yogic practices, sometimes without a teacher or supervision, but just from like a DVD, you can do those kinds of things, or Qigong, or meditation practice. Sometimes people have experiences where they're in an altered state, kind of disconnected from everyday consensual reality, may have unusual beliefs, and so on. And yet these are, you know, time-limited experiences that can be worked with, often in, you know, spiritual teachers know exactly how to handle these experiences. Jack Kornfield has written about somebody who was in a meditation retreat that he was leading, and in the middle of the silent retreat, you know, kind of barged into the dining hall and started to, you know, execute karate moves and tell people that he could see their auras, and, you know, it was just totally, you know, inappropriate, disconnected from the whole process. Now, in other meditation centers, when somebody has done that, and also growth centers like Esalen Institute, often they'll just call 911 and have the person taken to the local psychiatric hospital. That's actually exactly what was even happening at Esalen, and that's why Stan and Christina formed the Spiritual Emergence Network, was to find alternatives to doing that. So I got involved with this. It certainly, you know, was, you know, from my own experience, made a lot of sense. And there were a number of conferences. Esalen held a kind of a working conference on this topic that I actually led. And at a conference in 1989, I was on the organizing committee, and after the conference, which had 500 participants, we started to talk about, well, how would we get this even, you know, more recognized, that spiritual emergence can be a focus of clinical attention in some ways, that we decided the best way to get it out into the world would be to have a DSM category for spiritual emergency. And Francis Liu, professor of psychiatry at UCSF Medical School, and Robert Turner, a psychiatrist now in private practice in San Francisco, and I set out to do this, create or get a DSM category accepted. And, you know, it seemed very kind of far-fetched, but we decided to do it. It was a several-year process of reviewing the literature. I should mention that I also, during the in 1980s, published about 5 case studies of people who had experiences similar to my own in a way, that also, one is actually about a woman who got hospitalized, went to a day treatment center, and then went on to become a licensed marriage and family therapist. And I interviewed her and got her experience published in a journal that is distributed to all psychiatrists in the American Psychiatric Association as a way to get kind of, again, this perspective out into the, you know, recognized. So we reviewed literature, not, you know, including a number of case studies, as well as some surveys that showed that people do bring religious and spiritual issues into therapy, and also surveys showing that psychiatrists and psychologists and social workers and so on are not given any professional training in religion and spirituality, or how to work with religious and spiritual issues in therapy.
And that was eventually, the DSM was changed, and in the revision now they actually do have an official DSM diagnosis for spiritual or religious problem, which is quite an accomplishment considering how elaborate their bureaucracy and how many hoops you must have to jump through to get that to happen, all the politics and the things that are going on behind the scenes to actually get that successful. David, we don't have a lot of time, but I just wanted to ask you, are you hopeful for this continuing to progress in the future? I know you're working with the California Department of Mental Health, that you're also working with the Consumer Survivor Recovery Movement. Do you really feel like there's a change in the culture happening, and do you see the mental health system evolving more in a way that's going to be more open to the kind of perspective that you're presenting?
Well, I do think there is a kind of a global phenomenon of a spiritual awakening, people becoming more and more interested in spirituality. I know the number of transpersonal associations around the world has just been expanding over the last 15 years, with new transpersonal associations recently formed in Korea and Lithuania. There are now 27 different international transpersonal associations, and ATP, the Association for Transpersonal Psychology, which I'm co-president of, had a conference in India in this past January 2008, that had 450 people from over 40 different countries. So I do think there is a increasing interest in spirituality. And I use the term spirituality to represent something that's more universal and shared and tolerant and accepting of all different religious and spiritual paths. And I'm optimistic about that happening. Now, in California, the unique thing that's happened is that California voters passed a special tax on millionaires. And that tax has generated a significant amount of money for the development of programs in mental health, which is what this is targeted for. It must be used for this purpose. Actually, half goes to children's mental and physical health, and half goes to adult mental health. So within that, there's now this money for which programs can apply. And so I've been involved here in California with a group of consumers and religious professionals and people working in county mental health, and many of these roles overlap. We've been meeting for the past 2 years and pretty much monthly, sometimes by phone, sometimes face-to-face, and are now being recognized by the California Department of Mental Health, and we have submitted a grant proposal for $310,000 to develop innovative spiritual approaches in recovery programs around the state of California. So I feel like I'm now being given, you know, an opportunity to kind of put a lot of this into, you know, mainstream clinical practice in that area.
David, we're about out of time. Just give us some contact information. If people want to find out more about this perspective and your work, how could they get in touch with you, and what are maybe some websites that they could check out?
Well, I do maintain a website called the Spiritual Competency Resource Center. I have a number of articles of mine up there, including, for example, there's one on the history of this DSM category and the topics that were involved in that and so on. I'm actually starting to put up my own podcasts on that site as well.
Great. What's the web address for that?
It's www.spiritualcompetency, all one word, .com.
David Lukoff, thank you so much for joining us today on Madness Radio.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking with you.
You've been listening to an interview with David Lukoff. He is a clinical psychologist and professor of psychology at the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology in Palo Alto, California. He is the co-author of the DSM-4 category, Religious or Spiritual Problem. That's about all the time we have this week on Madness Radio. Thanks a lot for tuning in. You've been listening to Madness Radio, voices and visions from outside mental health. Madness Radio broadcasts every Tuesday, 4 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Pacifica affiliates WXOJLPFM, Northampton, Massachusetts, and KWMD Kasilof and Anchorage, Alaska. Produced by peer-run mental health communities freedom-center.org and theicarusproject.net. Listen to our internet stream, podcasts, and show archives at madnessradio.net. If you have an idea for a story or guest on Madness Radio to help us get broadcast on a station near you, or if you just want to share what's in your head, contact radio@madnessradio.net.